Hello and welcome to The Essential Sean Rocks. I'm Kieran Hines, and for the next hour we're celebrating an old friend of mine, and I'm sure of yours, the wonderful broadcaster Sean Rocks, who sadly passed away in July. Sean began presenting Arena on RTE Radio 1 in 2009, and over those 16 years his energy, knowledge and, above all, his curiosity had a profound impact on the way we think about the arts in this country. And as presenter of Arena, Sean spoke to every kind of artist you can think of. Novelists, musicians, poets, painters, photographers, even the odd actor or two. And he approached every single interview with a generosity of spirit that surely must have been forged during his own time as an artist, because, as you may know, Sean was a celebrated actor before he ventured into radio. And in 1989, I had the joy of working with Sean when we were both part of a company of actors that brought Yeats's Cuchulain play cycle to the Abbey Theatre. In fact, in one of those productions, on By the Strand, we played father and son, with myself as Cuchulain and Sean as the young man sent to kill the great warrior who, we've eventually learn, is in fact his father. Sean had a lovely way about him. He had an easy sense of humour, a great warmth, and a deep commitment to the work, which I always admired. And these are traits that stayed with him throughout his professional career beyond the stage and onto the national airwaves, as we'll hear over the next hour when we listen back to some of Sean's best Arena interviews. We'll begin with Jared Harris, a man who talked to Sean many times over the years about his work in film and television. But the last time they spoke, the subject was more personal than usual, because Jared was in Limerick for the opening of a new exhibition dedicated to his late father, the legendary actor Richard Harris. And as ever with Richard Harris, it didn't take long for the conversation to turn to sport and, of course, Munster Rugby.
This Sporting Life from 1963, the, you know, really one of the films that launched your father's film career, without any doubt. Obviously, it's a rugby theme. Obviously, it's very much, you can't think of Limerick City and Munster without thinking of rugby. Do we get any memorabilia from that aspect of your father's life? Because rugby is hugely important to him.
Oh, yeah. I think that somewhere in there, I'm not sure if it's here, there was a postcard, a card sent to him by a student here asking him not to come to the Munster matches because he was bad luck. And it, or if he did come, could he borrow Harry Potter's Cloak of Invisibility?
And wonderful that he would keep that sort of thing.
I'm saying he kept everything, you know. He kept everything. That was really surprising because, he didn't keep them in great condition either. Mm. I mean, they were thrown into suitcases and stuff like that, but it was all there.
And I believe, too, was there a letter towards the end of his life when he was actually quite sick, I think, from Daniel Radcliffe, Harry Potter himself, wishing him well.
That's there, yeah.
Again,
I mean, they visited him in hospital. I mean, initially it was looking quite good. It was looking like he was going to get out of there. So a lot of people were visiting, and then it just suddenly took a turn for the worse over a period of a couple of weeks.
The other aspect, of course, of the Harry Potter thing was it was kind of a late flourishing in terms of your father's career. He made some very interesting choices. I suppose this would be into the 1990s. How much did he talk to you about those choices that I'm thinking of?
Obviously? Well, he got nominated for a second time in the 90s for The Field. You know, there was a period there, the sort of decade before, where a lot of his time was spent touring Camelot around the world, the stage play. Mm. And that really was the reason why he was able to do the Pirandello play. Because he got his, and that's a weird thing to say, but he got his confidence back about being on stage, and he got his voice back, and he got his stamina back, and that was why he was able to tackle the Pirandello play. And then every producer in London was throwing ideas at him, and he was at one point that he was going to do a season of plays with Duncan Weldon and Thelma Holt, and he sort of committed to it. But he got nominated for The Field, and he got close. And then he kind of sort of got interested in trying to find another film role that would get him, you know, would get him the award. And his focus got split. And then by the time Wrestling Ernest Hemingway came out, which is a really wonderful movie, and it didn't happen with that, he'd let that discipline slip enough, and he didn't go back on stage again, which is a pity, because he had a lot to offer on stage.
Of course, you've made a return to the stage yourself in recent times.
Nice segue.
Well, you handed it to me, thank you. About 15 years out off the stage, and then
yes,
back with Claudius.
No, it was The Homecoming.
I beg your pardon.
And then this year it was, Claudius in Hamlet at the RSC. Yeah.
Claudius in Hamlet at the RSC. But what I thought about when I heard about Claudius in Hamlet at the RSC was back to you as the 40-year-old Jared Harris playing Hamlet in a small production in the United States, I think. This would have been close enough to your father's death. Would he have been aware of the choices you were making at that time? Would you have discussed them with him?
No, he played the ghost.
Ah.
We filmed him as the ghost. And so we projected his image onto a scrim each night, and he would appear. And so he absolutely knew. And he came and saw it.
And then what kind of discussions did you and he have?
I had loads of conversations about Hamlet with him already. And he had a very sort of particular take on a version of Hamlet that he wanted to do. He wrote it down in a screenplay. That's somewhere there in the archive. I don't think that's been, it hasn't been gone through yet. But because there's tons of stuff there that they're still archiving, I guess. That was one of his favourite subjects, was to sit there and talk about his interpretation of that play.
The other thing I wondered about, I mean, you've had such a success in terms of television in particular. We think of The Crown, we think of Chernobyl, we think of Foundation, which is on Apple TV Plus as well. But what kind of roles could your father have played in this new world of, you know, these long-form television pieces, which allow for more, I think one could argue, than modern-day cinema often allows for?
Well, I mean, there's probably some of the stories he wanted to tell would have fared better in that format. There's different opportunities to pitch to an audience when you've got that kind of stuff as opposed to a two-hour or three-hour movie. But he wasn't satisfied unless he was playing the lead. He would have to have been the central character of the story.
And could you see him? In your own head, have you seen him?
It's a pity, because the part of Dumbledore got more interesting as you went from movie to movie, and it became a bigger and bigger role and a more central role to the story. And he would have enjoyed that very much.
Yeah, and I mean, famously, he said that he took on the part of Dumbledore because his granddaughter Ella would never have forgiven him had he not done
it.
You're inclined to say perhaps that is part of Richard Harris playing into the Richard Harris persona.
Well, I mean, it's not so much the persona as that he was a very canny person, you know. So he knew that the premiere was going to be a big event. So he was, I mean, what happened was, I called him up. There's all the coverage about the premiere in London. And I called him up at the Savoy and I said, "Dad, it's wall-to-wall coverage. This, you know, it's huge over here. All the news outlets and everything are talking about it. And there's only two interviews they're showing. One is Daniel Radcliffe's and the other is you with Ella." And he goes, "Ah, great, it worked." Because he had tried to stage manage that red carpet a year and a half earlier by putting that story out. And he brought Ella onto the red carpet so people would go, "Is this your granddaughter? Is she the one?" "Yes, she's the one." Yeah.
Well, that canniness, obviously, I'm not going to cast aspersions on the Midwest, but certainly the canniness of the Limerick man clearly coming out very strongly in that act. And the patience.
You said that, not me.
Yeah, I'm probably in trouble now. The patience, though, to wait that length of time. It shows something.
Well, it was again, you know, that story about when he's being taken out of the Savoy Hotel and he props himself up on an elbow and he goes, "It was the food. Look what your food has done to me." So when he gets he gets into the ambulance with my mother, and he had been very sick in the room, and they had to really talk him into agreeing to get into the ambulance. He didn't want to be moved. And when he's in the ambulance with my mother, she starts laughing and goes, "You are terrible. You know, that hotel must be desperate to get you out of there, you know." And he looked at her and he said, "Now that no one can sell the story." Because he wanted to work, and he didn't want a story to be told of Richard Harris wheeled out sick on a stretcher, and he didn't want anyone in the hotel to sell that story to the press. And now they couldn't, because there was a punchline and they were the butt of it.
Yeah, and how interesting that again he had that foresight to see how it would be portrayed in the newspapers and across television news, etc., etc. Let's have a listen to him in one of the late roles, and there's just something absolutely gorgeous about this as Marcus Aurelius with Russell Crowe as Maximus in Gladiator.
5,000 of my men are out there in the freezing mud. 3,000 of them are bloodied and cleaved. 2,000 will never leave this place. I will not believe that they fought and died for nothing.
And what would you believe?
They fought for you. And for Rome.
And what is Rome, Maximus?
I've seen much of the rest of the world. It is brutal and cruel and dark. Rome is the light.
Yet you have never been there. You have not seen what it has become. I am dying. When a man sees his end, he wants to know there was some purpose to his life. How will the world speak my name in years to come? Will I be known as the philosopher, the warrior, the tyrant? Or will I be the emperor who gave Rome back her true self? There was once a dream that was Rome. You could only whisper it. Anything more than a whisper. And it would vanish. It was so fragile. And I fear that it will not survive the winter.
And that is Richard Harris as Marcus Aurelius, Russell Crowe as Maximus from Gladiator. And Jared Harris is with me on the programme this evening talking about the upcoming exhibition From Dickie to Richard, Role of a Lifetime, an archival expression of the life of Richard Harris, which is at the Hunt Museum in Limerick. What a line. How will the world speak my name in years to come? It's very difficult not to think of your father as almost saying that of himself.
Well, that's one of those sort of moments where roles meld with the actor and the life story of the actor and what we know of the actor. So that was definitely a thought that was on his mind at that point. Was because when he describes himself as that character, he could be talking about himself and all the facets of his personality.
And in those terms, why do you think that, I said at the very top of our conversation, your father is so often described solely in terms of that, you know, that rabble-rouser, that rebellious character?
Do you mean why is that?
Yeah, why is he not seen?
Because the press want to sell newspapers and he knew it, you know?
Yeah,
now they want, it would be clicks now. So it was that version of clickbait.
Yeah, it would be exactly. Yeah, likes would be enough. That would make them happy. But it is very difficult. Well, I find it very difficult to listen to that line and not think of so much of himself. You know, I didn't know him in the way that obviously you would have as a son. But to see,
I mean,
hear him
one
in
of
it.
The things that we use that clip in the documentary, and one of the things that people come away from the documentary not knowing was that he had this huge singing career. And the poetry, and there was this other life to him. They would know him in his sort of his by reputation, then as an actor. But then you go, well, there was actually other facets to a career here that people weren't aware of.
Yeah, because as I was listening to that clip just now, it struck me how wonderful the language is within it. Now I know that's in the writing of the screenplay, obviously, but your father delivered it. How good is his poetry? How when you're reading it as with your actor's head on, how good is it?
There's beautiful stuff in there. I mean, that his poetry, "Too Many Saviors," is still one of the most brilliant arguments against you know, a sectarian divide, and like the argument about whose side God is on. And in the poem, God is saying, I'm on neither of your side. You know, not if you're going to behave like this and fight like this. It's a fantastic poem.
Is there a one man show starring one Jared Harris of those of those poems?
I don't think so. You know who does a beautiful rendition of it? Stephen Ray. He did a wonderful for the documentary. Really wonderful, because it was so full of query and questioning and a sense of hurt. And my father's rendition of it came from a sense of anger and of disappointment. It was wonderful to hear these different options available to great actors when you give them that kind of material.
Jared Harris speaking with Sean Rocks about his father and Limerick's finest, Richard Harris. Now, you'll have heard Jared mention Stephen Ray at the end of that piece, and Sean did a special public interview with Stephen in January at an event in his honour during this year's Tradfest. Other guests on the night included the actor Sinead Cusack and the piper Louise Mulcahy. Sean's wide-ranging conversation with Stephen began with a performance.
Let us start with the thing most of us want to hear from Stephen Ray. Stephen is going to begin with a poem by his dear friend, Derek Mahon. Very much a piece that speaks to the times we live in. The Derek Mahon piece is called Trump Time. And performing that piece, Stephen Ray, accompanied by piper Louise Mulcahy.
Nineveh, Tyre, and Carthage are long gone. Also Troy and the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Now Britain's empire is a thing of the past, and Anglia too will have an end at last. Oh, not an end, but a slow decline at least. Whitman and Moby Dick, F. Scott Fitzgerald will still be read, Gershwin and Satchmo heard, movies downloaded. But the wider world will think of other things as it did once. Hard rock and carpet bombings will be down. Apple and Goldman Sachs down with the rest. Some peace and quiet once again in evidence. Where a spring rises in the little wood of birch and sycamore beside the house, I stand and listen to the undying source whispering there. I'd travel, if I could, through the lost ages to a distant time when it was sacred to a pre-Christian god. I'd tie a token on a thorn and climb back to the present, sure in the belief we can still touch the origins of life. Relish perspective, silence, solitude, far from the bedlam of acquisitive force that rules us and would rule the universe. Such things survive, beloved of poet and artist, only where their despoilers haven't noticed. In a yard or a hidden cove out on the edge, the rushy meadow and the fallow acre ripe for development as industrial plant, serving as temple, shrine, and sepulcher. These places minister to the soul by dint of radiating a strange air of privilege. And here we live, not in a petulant rage for world dominion, but an inner continent of long twilights shrouded in mist and rain. The lasting features of our lost domain.
Louise Mulcahy on pipes and the voice of Stephen Ray there reading Trump Time by Derek Mahon. I think it's fair to say that your collaboration with director Neil Jordan, your many collaborations with director Neil Jordan, has been most fruitful, but in particular The Crying Game from 1992, which was such a groundbreaking film when you think of it now. It seems easy now in 2025. Mm-hmm. But you had worked with Neil before that on Angel.
That was his first film and my first film.
Yeah, and have you watched that in recent times? Do you go back and watch it?
I watched it maybe 2 years ago in a festival, you know. And, it's just excruciating to watch yourself, really, you know. But
I watched it. I watched it about a week ago. And I'd seen it before, but I was absolutely taken with Steve's work and Neil's work. Mm. But to watch the young Stephen on screen, there's something about Stephen's work on screen. Now, don't be embarrassed by this, but he holds secrets, and you always want to find out what he's thinking. And he can do compassion and cruelty almost on the turn of a sixpence. It's amazing, really, as a first movie.
Yeah, and it was the story of this young saxophonist who witnesses the murder of a young girl, a young deaf mute, and it's the manager of the venue, isn't it, or his own manager, and he sees the murder, and that leads them into all sorts of areas. But at that time, was it around then that Neil Jordan started to tell you about, I have this other idea?
No, he didn't. That was for a good way. He did a film called Company of Wolves.
Oh, yes, and you were part of that too.
Actually, if you look at it now, it's a really great film. But then he did a couple of other ones without me, and they weren't any good.
Can I ask you, Steve, just about the playing of the sax?
Yes.
You know, the character was called the Stan Getz of South Armagh, and Steve is absolutely credible.
Well, I was taught by a wonderful saxophone player called Keith Donald.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a wonderful guy. And actually,
Moving Hearts players. We played with Moving Hearts, I think, along the way, didn't he? A lot of the time, yeah.
Wonderful player. But he did the recordings that I mimed to, you know.
Right.
And he taught me all the tricks of the saxophone and all that, you know. And at the same time, Robert De Niro had just done a movie where he played a saxophone player, and they were all saying, oh, he's as great as Charlie Parker and all that, you know. And I thought, I said to Keith, what am I going to do? You know, De Niro is supposed to be better than Charlie Parker. And he said, I've got a copy of the film, I'm going to look at it. And he came in the next morning, he says, I saw the film, you've got nothing to worry about.
But The Crying Game, Neil Jordan did come to you with it. At a time it was called The Soldier's Wife?
Yes, it was. What a bad title, really. No, that's right. Well, you see, he didn't send me a script. He just told me the story. And will I reveal the secret?
Well, spoiler alert, if you haven't seen The Crying Game, go up and put, go over and turn on the kettle. It'll be noisy by the time Stephen gets to telling you what happens.
No, well, he has a scene with this beautiful young woman, and then he goes back to her apartment and discovers that, in fact, she's a man. Don't be so shocked. And, yeah, well, you see, the thing is that everything he was doing in that film was about identity, you know, challenging, you know, fixed ideas of identity. And that's what fascinated people, because it wasn't, it made everything less narrow, you know. And it's a truly tremendous piece of work. I saw it a couple of years ago, there was a new thing of it, and I just said, I wasn't going to watch it, but I watched it, and then I said to Neil, it's a masterpiece.
The mighty Stephen Ray, speaking to Sean Rocks about his role in Neil Jordan's The Crying Game. And of course, we heard from Sinead Cusack there too. Next to the Grammy Award-winning musician and storyteller Rhiannon Giddens, a woman with deep connections to Ireland. Like so many artists based here, she was a regular guest of Sean's on Arena. And in January this year, she spoke to Sean ahead of her appearance at the Kerry Festival called Your Roots Are Showing. But before we listen to that conversation, let's hear Rhiannon's powerful take on The Ballad of Sally Ann.
Rhiannon Giddens there with her wonderful version of The Ballad of Sally Ann. It's an extraordinary story, The Ballad of Sally Ann, Rhiannon, because you're listening, oh, this is a very happy little bit of gentle banjo plucking at the beginning and everything's going great. And then we hear Strange Fruit and then we hear what happens to them on their way to the wedding. It's so dark when it gets going.
It is. It's a really dark song, but it's meant to be. You know, it's by Alice Randall, and she's a, you know, African-American songwriter who's been living in Nashville for years, writing songs for Black women to sing that no one was letting Black women sing back when she was writing them. You know what I mean? So, you know, like folks like Mark O'Connor and other lovely musicians, you know, would cover her songs, but like she never heard them sung like she had written them. So this is obviously a song about lynching that was done sort of in this up-tempo sort of bluegrass style, like back in the day when it was originally recorded. And so this is part of a larger project that she was able to put together, having, you know, Black female singers do her songs. And I just want to mention, you know, that was recorded, my side of that track was recorded in here in Ireland with my longtime colleagues, Francesco Teresi and Ben Rollins. And then it was produced, you know, there's other stuff produced on it by Ebony Smith in Nashville. So it was a real kind of bi-country experience. But like, you know, there's a lot of good stuff happening here in Ireland. I always like to put that plug in.
Yeah,
know?
Well, thanks for mentioning it. And it's in some ways, that song for me links into this wonderful festival and conference that you're involved in, Your Roots Are Showing, because Your Roots Are Showing, it's a kind of a two-sided statement, isn't it? When we think of that ballad that we've just heard and you're talking about Olive Randall not hearing it the way she wanted to hear it, because Your Roots Are Showing isn't always a compliment, but I think what you would believe is let your roots show, let them get out there, let them be seen.
I think so. I think that's where we're at right now. You know, there's been so many mythologies told about it. Well, I can speak specifically about American music because that's my thing. There's been so much mythology, you know, made up about American music that has really covered up, you know, a lot of the original roots of where it comes from. And that happens actually in a lot of different places. Wherever you have nationalism, you have mythology making. And that usually means that some of the folks who were originally there at the beginning of the story don't get talked about. And that's certainly been the case with, you know, say country music, old time music, bluegrass music in terms of, you know, African-American co-creation and involvement. And I think, you know, having a conference named that, I think is really important because it talks about, you know, what is traditionalism? What is, you know, what is folk music? What are we calling it? Because it's not just about what we play, you know, it's also about how we talk about it and what we're bringing to it. And I think it's really important to create a space for that.
It also struck me, as you say, upbeat bluegrass style that is there across this incredibly dark story. Was that in some ways, and I know this is done across pop music even today, you get sad songs that are upbeat, but was that a way of potentially masking the roots rather than hiding them, if you know what I mean? That you were saying, yeah, this is a dark song, but some people will just hear the upbeat music and they'll clap along with it, they won't even listen to the words.
I think that's part of the style. You know, there's a lot of, I mean, it's the same, it's kind of a hallmark of old time music and bluegrass music is, you know, these really serious things that you kind of hear, like you get halfway through the song and you're like, wait a minute, you know, it is part of the style, but also Alice, you know, used the tools that she was given. So like whoever was going to cover her song at that point, it wasn't who she wrote it for, but she wanted the song to get out there. And then now years later, you know, it's already been out there so that it can be covered by somebody like me. You know, you do what's in front of you. You use the tools that you're given. And I think that getting a story out there in whichever way that you are able to is part of what folk music does as well. You know, it's like, I don't think you should have to do that, but if it works in a lot of different ways, I guess is what I'm saying. Like, so I took it and I made it much darker and I kind of rewrote the melody a little bit. And 'cause it was kind of a traditional melody and it's still a banjo, but it's my banjo. It's a replica from 1858, and it's the deeper, darker, you know, soulful version of that original recording, however many years ago. So it's, you know, I think it works in its own way. Sometimes you want it to be a little lighter so that the punch of it hits you in a certain way, but also sometimes you just want to say, this is a freaking sad song. You know, here we go.
Mind you, you talk about your banjo. Your banjo is quite the instrument and what you've done for the instrument. And I've said this, I suppose your banjo almost metaphorically, you have taken that instrument, possibly one that was scoffed at, possibly one that was derided for a long period of time. And you've brought it into the mainstream, even into opera.
You know, I'm still kind of stunned at what I've been given opportunities to do. It's my banjo has been, you know, Red Dead Redemption 2, one of the biggest selling video games, you know, ever. It's on that soundtrack. It's on a Beyonce song. I wrote an opera on it. You know, it's been kind of everywhere. And people don't even know it's me. You know what I mean? But they've heard that sound. And that to me is the best thing ever. I've never, you know, been into this for celebrity or for putting myself anywhere, but if I can get that banjo, you know, the banjo, as you said, has been so maligned. It's been so turned into sort of a comedy instrument, but the roots of it are so deep and they're so spiritual. And obviously it's an African derived instrument. And I just feel like I've just taken every opportunity I can to just slide that sound in there, you know, so people don't even know it's a banjo sometimes at first. And then they go, oh, wow, that's a banjo I can get behind. You know what I mean? So it's been, I've just been really fortunate, and I've just tried to do as much as I can to get it where people don't expect it.
And as you say, you know, bringing it into a Beyonce song, bringing it into opera, bringing the banjo into that kind of mainstream and into that high art end of things, that is rehabilitation the right word?
I mean, I think there's me and a bunch of us. There's a banjo crew, folks who've been trying to rehabilitate the banjo, to reclaim the banjo, to show people the real history of it, you know, because it has been so mythologized and so sort of one-dimensionalized. And it's not just me. I'm just one of many. I think it's been really important because it is really one of the true American instruments. You know, if you think about America as a nation state, it's like it is... Africa meets Europe. Like, absolutely. Mm. It is, I think, a true representation of what so much of American music is. And it just represents it in itself. And I think that that's a really powerful emblem, and it needs to be taken as a serious emblem. Obviously, it can be a lot of fun, but it has to be at its core, you know, taken seriously, because it really represents a lot of really tough history.
Rhiannon Giddens, great to speak with you, and thanks so much for being with us. But let's finish up by listening to Swannanoa, or Asheville Junction, with Rhiannon Giddens. Thanks, Rhiannon.
Thank you. Somebody's round when you hear that hoot-owl squalling. Somebody died, babe. Somebody died. Hammer falling from my shoulder all day long, babe. All day long. I'm going back to Swannanoa Tunnel. That's my home, babe. That's my home.
Rhiannon Giddens there with Swannanoa Tunnel. You're listening to The Essential Sean Rocks here on RTE Radio 1. We're remembering our dear friend Sean by listening back to some of his best work. I'm Kieran Hines. Well, the actor Eileen Walsh has had a fascinating career combining television, film and her first love, theatre. In May, when she last spoke to Sean, she was preparing for a highly experimental play called The Second Woman, a demanding performance piece in which she played the same scene 100 times over the course of 24 hours, each time with a new scene partner. Naturally, Sean was fascinated.
What mad pill were you taking that day when you said, I'd love to do that?
Come on, I'll give it a go. I actually got to see the production when it happened in London with Ruth Wilson at the Young Vic. Mm. And it was so thrilling and so like a Marina Abramovich or something like that. Just, yeah. You can't control.
Almost like the artist is present. You're sitting there, a new actor arrives out, off you go.
Yeah, and it's such a lesson in letting go. Mm. Seeing what comes in the door. You can't really prepare. I can prepare for the repetition and I can prepare for how to get out of a sticky situation. Yeah. But I don't know what each person is going to bring in that door.
So do you have a set script? In other words, you learn your lines and no matter what happens, you say those lines, or is there a little bit of leeway within all of that?
Yeah, so there's 3 pages of dialogue and direction. Mm. The scene opens with an opportunity for the participant to say something that will be different, and I can respond to that. And then there's 2 pages of dialogue that are very much stuck to, but that includes getting a drink, eating some noodles and having a little discussion about trying to win him
props
back.
Props and business and
everything. I know. And then we share a kind of an intimate dance moment.
So this is, there's a scenario then. What's the relationship between the man and the woman? Because is it always a man, yeah?
Yeah. So the play itself, it's called The Second Woman, and it's based on a John Cassavetes film called Opening Night, where Jenna Rollins, who was Cassavetes' wife, Jenna plays this aging actor who is coming to terms with the life choices she's made and is having this very slow breakdown over the course of the film. And in the film, they're presenting this play, The Second Woman. She has an ex-lover in the play. And this is the scene where she turns up to the ex-lover and she's trying to get him interested in her again. And he isn't necessarily interested because he feels like she's trying to use him for the play.
Okay, so but you have 100 different actors coming out over this 24-hour period. How long is the scene? Is it about 10
minutes?
It's
about 7 minutes.
7 minutes, okay.
Yeah.
So that's about, what is it, 4 or 5 an hour? Six.
And then you've got like
seven,
a brief, you've got a brief few minutes at the end of each hour to reset props, drinking glasses, you know, if your makeup is smudged or, you know, quick little checks.
And the actor, does he come out with set lines or, you know, is he allowed
He has a brief kind of, there's a slight looseness around the beginning of it. So,
that the opening section,
they can choose.
They can say whatever they want.
Yeah, you know, because perhaps they might want to say, look, as your father, they might want to distance themselves and not do a romantic scene, so that's okay too. And then at the end, they get to choose to leave on a positive or a negative. So each scene ending will also be different depending on his choice.
Yeah, and I guess they can come in annoyed at you, or they can come in thinking, you know, I still feel great about this woman or whatever.
Yes, it can be romantic or it can be funny. It can be clumsy. They can be nervous. You know, a lot of them are just people who are willing to throw their hat into the ring.
Yeah,
they're not necessarily actors.
What kind of strikes me most about that is there's no way. How can you rehearse it? You can't get 100 different people every day for 3 weeks to rehearse it.
No, exactly. Well, and the two women that created it, Anna Brecken and Nat Randall, they've done it so many times. They've got a really restricted rehearsal. They know exactly what they're doing. And a lot of it is, I suppose, people management skills and me learning that and being physically open to whatever is going to be thrown at you.
And the audience then, how long are they there for?
So you can stay as long as you like. You can do the whole crazy trip with me for 24 hours or you can come and go. And even if you get the 24-hour ticket, you know, you can take rest breaks.
Oh, right,
you can kind of come in and out. There'll be amazing food pop-ups outside in the opera house.
What about you and your food
pop-ups?
I'll have
plenty of noodles and I'll be running on adrenaline.
And do you sleep? Do you get a break at any point?
There's no sleeping. Now, Sean, I don't know how I'm going to manage that because I love my sleep. But
24 hours?
Yeah. Yeah.
It really is a marathon.
I know.
So when you went to see it in London, how long did you spend in the theatre?
We had to queue for 3 hours and even the queue was a buzz.
Kind of excitement. Yeah.
There was people kind of, you know, up and down the queue with lots of kind of chats going on and people were really kind of enthusiastic about seeing it. So we queued for 3 hours and then we finally got our ticket in and we watched for 3 hours. So by the time I left, it was like midnight.
So how many did you see in that period of time? I suppose
if it's 21, 6 or 7,
I saw 21 times. 7 an hour.
Yeah,
7 sevens is 49. Yeah. So yeah, okay. So about seven an hour. So you had seen 21 of the 100
iterations of it, and not one famous person, but all very capable. Even those that were obviously not actors, that were quite stunned by an audience looking at them, you know.
And this is the Opera House, isn't it? So it's not as if, I mean, a non-actor, it's not as if they're getting up in a little, you know, a small studio space.
No, it's big. Yeah. It's big or go home. It's going to be very exciting. And then there's 3 camera operators as well. So a lot of the smaller moments, touches and just details will be projected up on screen as well.
And Anne Bracken and Nat Randall, you mentioned the two women involved in it. They are directing this, are they?
Yeah,
you've spoken with them at this point.
Yeah, so it's all part of Cork Midsummer Festival, and but the women are coming over, and we'll do a full 2 weeks of rehearsal, be that to physically prepare as well as kind of get the right timings of everything. So I'll have them in the room, and we'll be rehearsing in Cork, and then we move into the Opera House.
Actually, it was with Cork and the Opera House. That was what made you. That was what made you take the part. So, but I return to my first question: what mad pill were you taking? I mean, are you not afraid?
I'm terrified, but in a really good way. I think I kind of exist on yes, and just jump. We'll worry about it later. Mm. You know, I was doing a yoga class recently and the teacher said, I know sometimes it feels like we're free falling without a parachute. And then she said, but the good news is there's no earth either. As you think, okay, if I can exist in that, just we're just free falling. That's all we're all doing.
So that's what you would be doing.
And that's
for,
the
for,
performance
for,
note.
For 24 hours. That aspect of it, I mean, obviously, there is the thing that you want this challenge, you want to face that fear. Has that always been a kind of a driving force for you? You know, face the thing that you're most afraid of.
Yeah, I think you jump in, and sometimes you know you can question your choices, but the majority of the time it works out. There's reasons for doing things. You're led, and you don't know why, and you know, otherwise you'd think too much and you'd think yourself out of it.
Yeah,
you know, so sometimes it's better to just say yes.
And I mean, I think back into this, I go back into the mists of time when I go back to Disco Pigs and yourself and Cillian Murphy, two young actors at that time doing that piece. Do you think there was the same type of fear then, or as many of us did when we were younger? We had less fear, didn't realise what we were letting ourselves
because
in
we were, yeah, we weren't afraid of judgment, really. I think it becomes more fearful now because you're afraid of failure. But, you know, that's all part of any creative job. And I think, to be fair, when I first read Disco Pigs, I hadn't a clue what it was about or what was happening in it. So you just, it was the urge to work and to do something. And Enda spoke with such enthusiasm for it. I kind of felt like, yeah, I want to spend my summer with you, you know. So he was the reason.
And I mean, I heard him speaking recently about that was the thing that kind of established everything for him, that play. I mean, it ran for, what was it, 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, we did 2 years everywhere, and then we jumped off, and it was taken on. And then I was only just saying to somebody there outside that I then, the three of us went back and saw it at the Young Vic. Kale, Enda and myself, we saw
recently.
Charlie Murphy in it. Right. Yeah, it was amazing.
The actor Eileen Walsh with Sean Rocks in May there, reflecting on her early work in Disco Pigs with Cillian Murphy and the playwright Enda Walsh. To bring this first part of The Essential Sean Rocks to a close, a conversation between Sean and the composer Colm McInerney about his work creating the score for the RTE1 documentary series From That Small Island, which charts the history of Ireland.
This is an extraordinary project. I was just you sent us in an awful lot of the music in separate little files, which makes it easier for us, obviously, to play it. What is 20,000 years across 4 hours of television?
Yes,
that's a lot of music.
Yeah, it is a lot of music. And I suppose the nature of it being a whistle-stop journey through Irish history, I suppose, necessitated that there would be a huge amount of music to aid the storytelling and to kind of keep things moving along, and also to be able to help the viewer process all of the information and kind of engage with it emotionally, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, and I suppose there's that thing that you could shift from the sparseness in many ways of the island. Yes, it was flourishing and loads of stuff was growing here, but without many inhabitants, there's a sparseness to that. But you're going to bring it right up through the famine period into the revolutionary periods, right up to the contemporary, to modern day and the peace process. There's a lot of styles and sounds that
you have
to put in there.
Yeah, I mean, thankfully, I mean, it was definitely a labour of love. You know, it's I grew up in the, you know, early 70s as a, you know, well, you know, what is all a lot of action happening here. And, you know, as an Irish speaker growing up in Dublin from earliest times, you know, I was asking myself and my parents, well, you know, how did this exactly happen that we are the only Irish speaking family on our road in Dublin? And so, and to visiting grandparents and, you know, seeing my grandfather's IRA medal in a chest, and next to it was his brother's, you know, British Army medals. So it's a very kind of complex history we have, you know, and
the historical side of things. I think that was always an interest for you, as you've just described there before. Even music was there. Let's listen to, and I think it's the best way to kind of illustrate
part of what you do here. And it was a moment in the first episode, and I'm far into it, it's maybe 9 or 10 minutes, something like that, into the first episode, when I really sat up and there's a shift in the tone in the music when we head off to the Cage of Fields, in fact, is the section that I have here. And in Mayo, obviously, UCD Professor Seamus Caulfield is kind of telling us about the history of that particular area and the people that lived there. Colin Farrell's narration is in there as well. And at the end of it all, the wonderful voice of Seamus Heaney.
In terms of world history, what we have here is an exceptionally early example of structuring the land into fields and controlled agriculture, if you like.
Underneath this vast area is a complete system of fields laid out by our first farmers and marked by stone walls. They remained hidden for thousands of years by the bog which grew over them.
I grew up a couple of hundred yards from here, and my father, Patrick Caulfield, when he was cutting turf in the 1930s on our own bog, just over a few hundred yards from here, he noticed lines of stones. And he recognised that he wasn't an archaeologist, but that they had to be older than the bog, therefore very ancient.
When he stripped off Blanket Bog, the soft piled centuries fell open like a glib. A landscape fossilised, its stone wall patternings repeated before our eyes in the stone walls of Mayo.
There we have a little clip from that small island, which is the new documentary series. Colm McInamara, composer of the original score for the series, is with me in studio this evening. Just as I listened to that section, which is a minute and 16 seconds long or something like that, and there is that beautiful violin fiddle tune playing in the background, then you have the voice of Seamus Caulfield coming in, the soft, intimate tones of Colin Farrell. He really does speak directly to us. There's not a hint of performance in what he's doing.
It's funny because, before we were good, you know, halfway through the project before I heard Colin reading the voiceover. So it was very much, and I understood actually how important it would be. It's like kind of you're recording a song that there's the guide vocal and there's the actual take. So when his recording came in then, it was so intimate that I realised that, you know, you're working with a kind of a way smaller kind of dynamic window. You know, there wouldn't be, it wasn't a, definitely wasn't a kind of a bombastic sort of, you know, and then this happened or, you know, so it's very much, it's very engaging.
Yeah, it is. It's, he really has a way of, you feel that you're being spoken directly
exactly,
to and
yeah.
you're not getting a lecture on, you know, a whole set of historical facts. You're really being told a story.
Exactly.
That's the way he seems to do it. You were saying that you know Seamus Caulfield.
Well, yeah, Seamus
well.
I was in that year in UCD many year decades ago. I studied archaeology as well, so I would have learned all about the Beaker people with Seamus Caulfield.
So some of the stuff that you heard him saying
yeah, exactly,
in the series
yeah,
you must have heard
sure.
before in,
yeah.
In a yeah. different context. And again, the voice of Seamus Heaney that comes in at the end there with the section from Bell Derrick, one of the poems from the collection North, which incidentally is 50 years old this year as well. Similar to a different voice from Colin Farrell, obviously, but a voice that has such rich sonority in it. You wouldn't want to be competing in any way with it.
Yeah, well, it's. I suppose my role is quite clear, you know, so I'm a servant to the story and facilitator. So in that, you know, it requires kind of humility. I mean, you know, I don't think any musician necessarily enjoys somebody talking over their music.
Did they do that on radio? I'd say as well. I bet you they do.
But so I think you know what you're in for. You know, so you know, but he does it very well.
It's not all quiet, reflective, gentle scenes either, because obviously you're going through battles
it's a maelstrom really. Yeah,
let's have a listen to what you put into place for, I suppose, the only date I could ever remember, 10/14 for the Battle of Clontarf. I was hopeless on remembering dates, but I always remember that one. I have no idea why it stuck in my head, and here is the music that you have for that particular moment.
Music there from Colin McNamara's score for the documentary series From That Small Island, which, by the way, is still available to watch on the RTE player. Well, that's it for part one of The Essential Sean Rocks. I hope you've enjoyed listening back to Sean's work. I'll be back tomorrow at 4 p.m. on RTE Radio 1 with part two of The Essential Sean Rocks. We'll hear interviews with actors like Fiona Shaw and Helena Bonham Carter, and we'll have music from the wonderful Éireann O'Leonard. So join me, Ciarán Hinds, again on RTE Radio 1 at 4 o'clock tomorrow to remember our friend, Sean Rocks. Until then, goodbye, and thanks for listening.